Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs some four decades ago. Well, the war is still being fought, and there aren't too many people who feel we're winning it. The recent surge in heroin and opiate use and abuse is the latest chapter. In 2015, heroin and opiate-related overdose deaths averaged close to one a day in our area alone. In order to focus public attention on this part of the problem, the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse is once again this year sponsoring a local public service announcement on heroin abuse to air in Sunday's Super Bowl. Well over a million regional viewers watched last year's very powerful spot. Joining me in studio to talk about the ad, the war on drugs, and about rethinking the approach to the drug problem is Howard Weissman, Executive Director for the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, St. Louis. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's a big weekend for you.
Yeah, we're 3 days away.
And, you know, last year the public service announcement that you aired got a lot of attention, very controversial. Why was it controversial?
Well, I don't know that it was controversial. I know that a number of people who we were not trying to reach were initially upset by the ad. And the people who we were not trying to reach were those who've already been touched by the heroin epidemic. So those who had recently lost family members felt like the jaunty music that accompanied those horrifying images that you saw in last year's spot was a little bit too much to bear. The juxtaposition of this happy-sounding music with these horrifying images was very, very jarring, and it was disturbing to people who already knew too well the catastrophe that heroin brings.
But that very thing could make it more effective, couldn't it?
That's the very thing that got people to watch. And our approach last year was very different than it is this year. Last year, people were not talking about heroin, even though over a person a day was dying. We had 407 deaths in 2014, and there wasn't a lot of coverage about it, which we found outrageous, really. So our approach then was, we're going to do whatever it takes. We're going to do whatever it takes to get the attention on this issue so that we can start talking about it and do something about it.
People are certainly talking about it now. I mean, anyone who's been following the presidential campaign, particularly the last week or so in New Hampshire, has seen all of the candidates up there, virtually all of them, talking about the heroin epidemic they're having in New Hampshire. New Hampshire, of all places.
Right. Yeah, the heroin epidemic is particularly bad in the Northeast. And as you recall, a couple of years ago, the governor of Vermont, Pete Shumlin, devoted his entire State of the State address to the heroin problem they were having in Vermont.
And, of course, we've got St. Louis County and we've got Madison County in particular where it's a special problem.
Yeah. St. Louis, in many ways, the St. Louis metropolitan area is not necessarily worse than much of the rest of the country, but that's horrifying in and of itself, that the problems that we're having here are to a certain degree typical of what's happening all over the rest of the country, and that's unacceptable.
Why is it happening all over the country? Why suddenly is heroin used to be a drug back in the 50s that everybody was talking about, and then it kind of went away or at least went underground a little bit?
Sure. Well, there's a few reasons for it, and we can talk about some of them. One is the overprescription of opioid pain medication. That is a huge contributing factor to this terrible epidemic. There's too much medication in too many people's medicine cabinets, and it's too easily available, too easily misused, and too easily diverted. Pain has been treated as the so-called fifth vital sign since the 1990s, and it's arguable whether or not that's really something that needs to be receiving the kind of strong, narcotic, addictive treatment that doctors have been bringing to it. It's been said that 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. And while it's certainly true that there are many people who wrestle with, you know, with chronic and horrible pain, and those people need effective treatment, It's also true that opioid pain medication is being prescribed for a host of problems for which it is terribly ill-suited. Back pain, chronic pain, fibromyalgia, diabetic neuropathy, rheumatoid arthritis. There are a number of conditions for which opioids are contraindicated.
Why does it lead directly to heroin use?
Well, these opioid pain medications, Don, are essentially heroin. They are a couple of molecules away from the heroin you buy on the street. The Vicodin, the hydrocodone, the oxycodone, the Percocet, the stuff that's commonly prescribed is all synthetic forms of opium. It's all synthetic forms of morphine, as is heroin.
But more expensive than heroin. There's the problem.
That's right. While, you know, we all have health insurance and pharmacy plans and we can get our prescriptions legally at a very reduced cost, if you want to try to obtain these things illegally, they're selling for about $1 a milligram. An 80-milligram tablet of oxycodone, it's about $80, where you can receive a stronger dose of heroin for $5 or $10. And the economics suggest that people switch to the cheaper alternative. The other thing to consider is that heroin is a lot more pure than it used to be. It's 4 to 10 times more pure than it was in the 70s. You referred to the 70s when heroin was a problem in urban areas. And the increased purity means that it no longer needs to be injected. People start, they initiate use sometimes by snorting it, by smoking it, or even by swallowing it in capsule or tablet form. It's compressed into tablets.
Who's using it? Is it mostly young people?
Heroin is primarily a drug being used in suburbs and in rural areas more than in urban areas. Drugs of all kind are equal opportunity destroyers, and they affect everyone of all social classes, of all colors. But this particular epidemic is more heavily concentrated on white folks and white folks in suburbs, white folks in rural areas, and white folks with money.
I have a comment here that someone who read on our website that we're going to be talking about this today in conjunction with what you've just said. AJ writes, urban black kids in North St. Louis have been killed or jailed because of the drug trade since the 80s, but now we're supposed to care because suburban white kids are using and overdosing. In my opinion, these PSAs seem tone deaf to the realities of these illegal markets.
You know, I understand the pain behind that comment. And what that comment is referring to is less about the way we're treating the heroin epidemic, and it's much more about the way we treated earlier epidemics. The heroin epidemic from the 70s that you mentioned and the crack epidemic from the 80s and early 90s. We took a law enforcement approach to those. We arrested people, we broke down doors, we shattered lives. We did not treat it as a public health problem. We treated it as a criminal problem. And you can say that that was a colossal injustice and something that was terribly unfair. It's also unfair that some kids get a second chance in life and others don't. And the truth of the matter is, the fact that it's happening in the suburbs to white kids and that it's happening to white kids whose parents might be senators or physicians or business leaders does something to remove the stigma that addiction has been shrouded in. And I would like to say that there is finally some degree of enlightenment that addiction is a chronic brain disease and needs to be treated that way. So I would like to hope that this rising tide of enlightenment will lift all ships.
I want to talk more about that in a moment. But first, getting back to the PSA, because I want to play that. Getting back to it, who are you targeting in this? Are you targeting young people, young suburban people specifically?
Well, we are. And, well, first of all, you can imagine, I mean, we're airing it on the Super Bowl, which has a very broad, very wide audience. Mm-hmm. So we want as many eyeballs on it as possible. But we are targeting this ad to a younger audience, and that's why there is an accompanying social media campaign with the ad. And we hope to engage younger folks through an Instagram campaign using the hashtag heroin.
That's the way to get at this generation, needless to say.
Before we play it, just very quickly, tell me what – obviously we can't show it, being radio. But can you explain kind of what people will be seeing when they see the ad?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The ad begins with hashtag heroin, with those letters. And behind it, you'll see an image of a young woman boiling heroin in a spoon. From there, you will see the same woman present in body but not in mind at a cheerleading practice. She is participating, literally just going through the motions while you hear a cheer. Give me an H, give me an E, spelling out the letters of heroin. Clearly, this is not coming from the cheerleaders. Clearly, this is coming from within the obsessed mind of this actress. She walks away from her friends. She walks away from the healthy, structured activity that she was engaged in. And for the next 54 seconds or so, she will lose everything that's important to her.
And the story is told and dramatized through the music. Let's take a listen to it now that you've explained it.
She's missing class, and she's dropping her pom-poms. Nobody knows where she is, not even her mom. Everybody thought she was the all-American girl. So there goes the books, it's all about the score. There goes the doggy, life is such a bore. There goes the family, she's got a new friend. There goes the looks, this is the end. I guess she really was the all-American girl.
Pick up heroin and you'll throw away everything you love. Share your stories on Instagram with hashtag heroin.
Well, that's the soundtrack to the PSA public service announcement that's going to be playing in Sunday's Super Bowl, sponsored by the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. And I have to say that the young lady starts in this video looking very attractive and very nice and very pretty and winds up a total mess.
That's the reality of what heroin and other drug addiction does to you.
That's Howard Weissman. He is the executive director of the organization I just mentioned. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Howard's got some ideas about how things should change and why things should change. You've gotten a hint of that already in our discussion. Back in just a moment, if you'd like to get into our conversation, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, do that at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Howard Weissman. Howard, you mentioned the impact of heroin on the brain a moment ago, and I think it's important to point out what is going on in young brains, the people who are so easily addicted. There is a component there that makes it easier for them to become addicted, isn't there?
In the same way that youth will learn a foreign language faster than we old folks, mm-hmm. and in the same way that they're going to learn algebra and trigonometry faster, they're also going to become addicted faster. All of the circuitry that is making connections in the brain is as active as it can be during adolescence. But parts of the brain that control sort of the most executive functions, risk assessment, decision making, those are less developed parts of the brain. So the teenage brain has been described as a car with a gas pedal but not a brake. Uh-huh. And anybody who's raised a teenager knows the wisdom behind that remark. And kids are particularly vulnerable to the consequences of substance use, of altering their consciousness with anything.
It was 1971, as I mentioned in the introduction, that Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs. Here it is, 2016. And there's still plenty of drugs around, obviously, and a lot of people say this war is not yet been won by a long shot. What
sure.
are your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you a very interesting thing about Nixon's war on drugs. Nixon wanted that to be a war on drug addiction, and he was advised that he'd be soft on crime. He'd be seen as soft on crime if he did what he wanted to do. And Richard Nixon, as imperfect as a person as he might have been, he wanted to devote three-quarters of the resources to treatment and prevention, and he wanted to devote a quarter of the resources to law enforcement and interdiction. We all know that that's not what happened. He was advised to fight a war against the, you know, the existence of drugs, the supply on drugs, and that was picked up by the Reagan administration later and the Just Say No campaign. And these things were tremendously unfair. The comment that you read from a listener earlier speaks to some of that. Think about the fact that in the 1980s, the criminal penalties for crack were 100 times worse than the criminal penalties for powdered cocaine. Mm. That's so clearly a kind of a racially tinged law enforcement policy to treat people unfairly. And there are elements of the war on drugs that have failed because you cannot stem the supply, particularly as long as there's demand. Mm-hmm. And in my view and in the view of many, the way you deal with this problem is not on the supply side. The way is on the demand side. And what's the best way to do that? And we can talk about it more later. It's prevention.
Prevention, and as you said earlier, be treated as a health problem as opposed to a criminal problem.
Correct.
With treated as a health problem, not something that needs a punitive reaction to it, correct?
That's right. And there's some innovative programming going on around the country. I just read about the Gloucester, Massachusetts Police Department initiating a program where if you come to the police department and tell them that you're wrestling with an addiction, they'll find you treatment. And programs like that, I think, are – that's the tip of the spear. That's the wave of what's going to be happening around the country.
Anything like that going on here and at any level of that kind of approach?
Well, you know, the DEA just started their DEA 360 program.
Yeah. Which is what?
Well, it's a partnership with some community agencies. It's a program to include not just interdiction and arresting more and more distributors and suppliers, but to address the problem again, like you just said, as a public health problem, and to try to get kids in some constructive activities and things like that.
Lots of talk today about decriminalization of drugs, even legalization. I mean, that's a conversation that's been going on for a long time. What's your take on that?
Well, really, that's a whole nother program.
Yeah, well, I know, but let's start it.
Well, I'll tell you that. There's a vast difference between decriminalization and legalization. So let's go back to the issue of heroin addiction as a public health problem. In fact, I would go so far as to call it a public health emergency. I think we all understand that young people really don't start using heroin, and they don't start with using prescription opioids. What do they start with? They start with the legal drug, alcohol, and they start with marijuana. Mm-hmm. So far and away, those are the two gateways to other and later drug use. And we could argue until the cows come home as to whether or not marijuana is a gateway drug, but we do know that the vast majority of people who go on to use harder drugs started with marijuana or alcohol. So it's clear that whatever we're going to do to effectively address the demand for drugs, we have to start intervening much further upstream. We have to start intervening with kids at a very young age before they're even thinking about experimenting with other drugs. It's clearly essential to remove criminal penalties for something like marijuana use. whether or not it makes sense to legalize marijuana and open it to commercial interests that are likely to do for marijuana what big tobacco did for cigarettes and what big alcohol has done, you know, for beer is, like I said, a discussion for another day. But we're having a very difficult time managing the two legal substances now. I'm sorry, the one legal substance, alcohol as well as tobacco. But tobacco actually provides a good example of maybe a way to deal with the heroin and other drug epidemics. It takes a massive public education campaign to begin to change people's behavior.
When you talk about intervention early on with young people, who's doing the intervening? Is it government, parents?
Well, it's a bit of a patchwork around the country. Here in St. Louis, there are agencies like NCADA that have multi-week, science-informed, research-based substance use prevention curricula that start in kindergarten and go all the way through grade 12. Now, there's a lot of confusion about or a lot of misunderstanding about what constitutes substance use prevention in kindergarten. And I can tell you that when we're working with young kids, we're not talking about drugs and alcohol at all. You know, we're in second grades talking about the difference between using porcupine words and teddy bear words. We're talking about how to communicate, how to resolve conflict, how to make friends, how to develop the life skills or resiliency skills that serve as protective factors. Yeah.
Our time is getting away, but I do want to get a couple of callers into the conversation. And we'll start with Ed, who is calling from Fenton. Pardon me, Ed. Go ahead with your question or comment, please. But we need to make it fairly quick.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was wondering if your guest is familiar with epibatidine.
Epibatidine, did you hear that?
No, I'm not.
It's an analgesic that was discovered about 30 years ago. Abbott Labs worked with it, and Tocris has it now. It hasn't been approved for human use from what I've been able to find out, but it's non-addictive and 60 times stronger than morphine. It seems like we have legalized addiction with how cheap and plentiful the opiates are when we have a viable option in a product like epibatidine.
Well, I can't speak to it meaningfully because I'm not familiar with the particular drug. I can tell you in general terms, however, that any drug that operates on the same sort of reward system that the opioids do are going to run the risk of becoming addictive.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for that call. Let's find Charles in St. Louis. Charles, go ahead. You're on the air.
John, and I'll make it quick. My wife and I both on occasions in the past have had pain, and we've taken hydrocodone as prescribed and used it as prescribed and ceased using it when we no longer have the pain. But now we can't get any sort of meaningful painkillers. The over-the-counter drugs are useless for us, and Tramadol is a very diluted drug, and that doesn't really help us out. So what do we do? We're part of the vast majority of people who don't abuse these drugs, and yet because a few do, we're being punished. I'll take my answer off the phone.
Well, there's a million stories in the Naked City, and I can tell you that there is no one drug policy that works for everybody. And there are many people who are taking medication responsibly and not becoming dependent on it. And it's also true that a number of health conditions that are treated with opioids are amenable to treatments that are now considered non-traditional and, you know, non-allopathic and part of outside of conventional medicine. And there needs to be greater understanding of pain, greater research into how to effectively treat and manage pain.
Are you suggesting, and I think this is the interpretation I have, are you suggesting that too many doctors are too quick to prescribe these things?
Yeah. oftentimes, doctors will use opioids as a first resort rather than a last resort. Now, that's changing. I think the consciousness is changing in the medical community. And as the gentleman alludes to, hydrocodone has been rescheduled, and it is now harder to come by. there are a variety of other ways to treat pain that doctors are never trained in and oftentimes don't have the time to get into. So many opportunities for alternatives sort of go by the wayside.
We have a couple of callers here that I can't get in because of a time constraint. Tom in Webster Groves, for instance, wants to know where the heroin is coming from. That's no big secret.
Well, it used to come from Afghanistan and places like that. Now it's coming from South America and from Mexico. A lot of marijuana fields have been torn up and replanted with poppy fields in Mexico.
And, of course, Afghanistan is still a big supplier to the world of heroin.
Yeah, the Golden Triangle in Southern Asia, for sure, and Colombia and parts of South America, Central America.
Another call, and this has to be a very quick response, is marijuana the gateway to the other things? You mentioned that a few minutes ago, but is that a step that is guaranteed?
Nothing's guaranteed. People are very, very complicated organisms, and anything you use to alter your consciousness makes you vulnerable to altering your consciousness with other things later on.
Right. In a few seconds, you're having a news conference on Monday following the Super Bowl, Ed, to announce something that we might want to know about?
I hope so. Mayor Slay, County Executive Stanger, and County Executive Ellman from St. Charles are going to be there, and I'm hopeful that they will be talking about initiatives in their communities.
We'll look forward to that. Howard Weissman, thank you so much for being with us. Hope the ad produces the kind of results you want.
Thank you.